I thought what I would do today is first take questions on stuff we did Monday, then take questions on anything else other than the China to cyberspace article, then essentially finish up the sort of more or less the chapter stuff on contract, and then take questions on China to cyberspace, and then talk about that. So that's sort of the current sequence. So to begin with, are there questions on the discussion of contract that we did Monday? Or other stuff in the contract chapter? All right, well then to review what we did, a good deal of the question is freedom of contract. That is, do we, or to what extent do you have a legal regime where whatever the parties agree to will be enforced? And the argument, the general argument in favor of freedom of contract is that it's in the rational self-interest of the parties to design a contract that maximizes the net benefit for them, and that therefore, as long as their contract doesn't have large negative effects on other people, letting them do that is going to tend to maximize the net benefit for everybody. And that then raises a number of obvious exceptions, a number of cases in which you might not believe in freedom of contract. And the clearest one is external costs. If our contract is a contract to have you assassinate somebody and you wimp out at the last minute, I don't get to sue to get my money back, that kind of contract is not enforceable, nor is a contract by which I agree not to testify to your criminal activities or things of that sort. Similarly, maybe more important, the U.S. at present will not enforce what we call a contract of restraint of trade. If you think about a cartel organization, everybody knows what a cartel is. Cartels are inherently fragile because if you've got a group of firms that are holding down output and holding up price, each firm would make more money if it increased its output. And there's therefore a tendency to do what's called chiseling, cheating on the cartel agreement, producing more. One solution to that is a contract. If we can contractually agree that we owe you large damages if we produce more than we said we would, that'll enforce the contract. I think in England, as late as about World War I, such contracts are still enforceable. I remember looking at one case involving one. In the U.S. and at present, and for quite a long time, they have not been enforceable. So that would be one example. Second reason you might not want to enforce freedom of contract is if you believe that the parties can't be trusted to act in their own interest, and that's the case of a lunatic or a child. And one might argue, although it gets much more iffy, that that's the case where the judge says no reasonable person would have agreed to these terms, therefore you must have been an unreasonable person when you agreed to it. And that's got the obvious problem. It depends on the judge after the fact second-guessing it. Another argument which comes up, which I'm mostly skeptical of, is the unequal bargaining power argument, which I've tried to argue in the chapter. That's thinking of the contract as sort of a tug of war. It makes more sense to think of it as simultaneously a tug of war and a cooperative project, that the parties want to cooperate to maximize the total benefit and then have their tug of war on how it's divided, and that normally even if I'm in a very strong position instead of having something you very much want, it makes sense to take that position in cash rather than insist on terms that benefit me by $100 and hurt you by $200, since that'll reduce the amount of cash I can get out of you by $200. And I then went through what seems to me a special case where the conclusion is not so clear, which I think helps explain people's sympathy for what I'm arguing is mostly a bad argument, and that's the case where freedom of contract means the amount you can squeeze out of me is more because of the fact that I'm basically using all my available resources anyway, and this the fact that I can commit to future payments means there are more resources I can give you. I then went on to talk about duress, where to me the most interesting case probably is the argument for showing that enforcing contracts under duress is not an unambiguously bad thing to do, that it really is a case of a benefit and a cost, and one can imagine real-world cases where the benefit of making such contracts enforceable is more than the cost, as well as one's worth less. Pinochet and parole arrangements in Europe a few hundred years ago are examples where that might well be the case. And then what strikes me, the other sort of interesting, economically interesting case, which is the sinking ship, and there the basic argument is that if you're making a contract on a price for towing a sinking ship, there is no price that gives the right incentive to both parties, therefore we have no good reason to think a bargaining will give us the price that gives the right incentive to both parties, and therefore, since there are potentially high transaction costs in that situation, it makes some sense to say that an admiralty court can revise the rules afterwards. And I think I commented at some point that one could imagine, and for all I know it happens, I don't know that industry, more elaborate contracts in which, in effect, rather than having a single price, you have one price for salvage and another price which represents the payment for you to be in a position to salvage, so to speak. That would get you closer to the optimal result. We talked a little bit about filling in blanks, about how courts are to interpret contracts, where the contract is ambiguous or even just doesn't cover some unlikely situation. And there's basically the argument that I sketched was that the court should figure out what the parties would have agreed to if it had been specified in the original negotiations for two reasons. One, the same reason that was the original reason for freedom of contract, because normally that'll represent the rules that maximize the net benefit from the contract. But secondly, because if they don't, that gives the parties an incentive to spend time and effort writing more detailed contracts in order that their preferences rather than the court's preferences will end up if these cases arise. That then got us to the question of breach of contract, where what you would like is some mechanism where breach occurs when breach produces net benefits and doesn't occur when it doesn't. You're concerned both about the sort of the pure case of opportunistic breach, which is the case where nothing changes from the beginning to the end, except that at some point I see that if I break my agreement, I can walk away with a benefit. And also the slightly more difficult case where something has changed so that under the original terms of the contract, completing the contract now makes me worse off. But breaching it makes you even more worse off, and therefore, if nothing happens, I've got an incentive to breach, not because I'm a nasty guy, but just because I don't like doing things that make me worse off. But on the other hand, my breaching produces net costs, so therefore we'd like to have some way to keep it from happening. And in that situation, there are really two possible mechanisms to keep it from happening. One of them is bargaining. If you imagine a world without enforceable contracts, there's still the possibility that when we both observe that the situation has changed such that it's now not in your interest to complete the contract, I might offer to raise the price I'm paying you in order that it'll be interest to complete. That's one possibility. Similarly, if you imagined a world where contracts were absolutely enforceable, specific performance, where you can have me hanged if I don't fulfill the contract, in that world, even if things change so it's not in our joint interest for me to fulfill, I could make you an offer to get you to let me off from the contract. The alternative method is damages for breach of contract. That's what we mostly do. That's the norm of enforceable contracts, since specific performance is an uncommon legal rule, except for real estate. And therefore, under damage rule, if the damage rule is what's called expectation damages, which imply that when I breach, I'm supposed to make you as well off as if I hadn't breached, that's just the standard Pigouvian tax approach, and it means I'm internalizing the externality, and therefore I'll make the right decision. There are two possible problems, but the clearest problem with that I discussed is the problem of inefficient reliance. Do people understand what I mean by reliance? Yes? No? Reliance means expenditures that I make which, in reliance on your fulfilling the contract, meaning expenditures that it's sensible for me to make if the contract is going to be fulfilled. So I'm relying on your fulfilling the contract. And the economically efficient rule is that if there's a 10% chance of you breaching the contract, I ought to engage in reliance only if it's still profitable with a 10% chance of that being wasted money. However, if the rule is expectation damages, then if you breach, I still get the money from my reliance because you've got to make me as well off as you hadn't breached. So if the rule is expectation damages, then I will rely as if there was no chance of breach, which might sometimes result in inefficient reliance. Is the argument clear? Not clear? I can't tell people's faces. All right. So Another rule is reliance damages. That turns out to have the same problem in spite of the name. The only difference is that reliance damages, I still have to make you as well off, but it's as well off as if we hadn't signed rather than as well off as if we had breached. And I make some attempt in the book to work through an advantage of reliance having to do with adverse selection on the sign, don't sign rule, but I'm not entirely happy with that discussion, so I'm going to leave it for the moment until I am. All right, let me go. Oh, and liquidated damages are the perfect solution if only you can predict the right amount. Because liquidated damages say that how much I owe you when I breach doesn't depend on whether you relied or not. Hence, you do lose your reliance money in breach. I breach, I owe you $1 million, but I owe you the same million whether you retooled your factory or not, and therefore the retooling money is down the drain if I breach. So under expectation damages, if they're set equal, sorry, under liquidated damages, they're set equal to the damage I do by breaching, then they give me the right incentive not to breach, and since they're fixed rather than depending on how much you spent on what, they give you the right incentive not to rely, or to rely when you should. All right, anything more on that? No. Let me then go on to the next question on contract, and that's the question of fraud. And I think I want to digress briefly to a point which I think I mentioned a little last time, which is the economics of speculation. That speculation is this interesting case where everybody except economists think it's evil. And economists think that not only is it not evil, but the thinking it's evil is evil. That is, I think I put it somewhere, the belief that speculation is wicked is one of the most lethal mistakes in history. Why? Because you live in an uncertain world. In an uncertain world, there are sometimes crop failures. Some people can predict the crop failures better than others because they have more expertise on whatever the relevant features are. It doesn't have to be crop failures. I'm taking that as one example. Given the possibility of speculation, if I see in advance that there's going to be a crop failure and therefore grain is going to be expensive, it pays me to buy grain and store it with the intent of selling it when it gets expensive. My doing that not only smooths out the price a bit, because when I sell it, that pushes the price down, it also gives other people an incentive to adjust to the failure in advance, because the price goes up sooner. When the price goes up, you say to yourself, well, maybe I shouldn't fatten those pigs. Maybe I should slaughter them now, because I'll need grain to feed the pigs, assuming you feed grain to pigs or cattle or something. You say to yourself, maybe I really should plant those potatoes I was thinking of planting because bread is expensive now, but they'll become ripe, you know, at a point where they'll probably still be expensive. You can think of a lot of ways in which people will modify either to produce more food or consume less once the price goes up and the speculator is pushing the price up earlier. All right, so in that sense, what the speculator is doing is preventing famines, decreasing famines, food speculators. Obviously, people speculate on lots of other things. On the other hand, when the famine comes, what do we observe? We observe that grain is expensive, my children are hungry, and look, there's that storehouse full of grain that that evil guy bought up, driving the price up. He's obviously the villain responsible, so therefore we ought to break into his storehouse, distribute the grain among the people, and the police, who will understand our righteous anger, are going to look the other way while we do it. If that's the attitude, then speculators anticipating it don't speculate, and we starve. That's why I'm thinking of it as a lethal error. That's the sort of standard economist view of speculation, and you can apply it to lots of things less dramatic than famines. The general argument is that if the speculator drives prices up when he buys, he drives them down when he sells, and that successful speculators buy when things are cheap and sell when they're expensive, and thus smooth out price. However, as I mentioned before, what's interesting economically about speculating is not any of that, but the fact that the reward to speculation is not related to the social benefit of speculation. Because even if you imagine a case where I find out the grain is going to be expensive 10 minutes before everybody else and buy up lots of grain then, so I push the price up 10 minutes earlier and it was at 10 in the evening and nobody's planting potatoes at 10 in the evening, so I have no social benefit at all, but it means that when the price goes up, it's my grain, not your grain, that's gone up, and therefore I make money. So therefore, the argument suggests that you could imagine cases either where you produce a benefit and don't make money, or you make money and don't produce a benefit, that they're unlike most market situations. The benefit, the social benefit, as it were, and the profit are not linked. Sort of an odd case. And this is, as far as I know, this was originally made by Jack Hirschleifer at UCLA, this particular point. And that then gets into contract issues because of the question of what is or isn't fraud. So that if I buy that grain from you, am I obliged to tell you before I buy it, by the way, I just got word that there was a bad harvest in some country that normally imports grain from us, so they'll be importing more grain, so the price will be higher. Or can I legitimately say, well, I didn't tell you that it wasn't happening. You know, it's up to you to know things. Interestingly enough, Thomas Aquinas discusses this question. I was reading him a long time ago because of issues about what he didn't or didn't believe about just prices. And when he takes the case where you have a wagon of food that you're taking to a famine-stricken area. And he says it would not be unjust if you don't tell the buyers that there are three more wagons behind you on the road. You'd be a better man if you did. It would be a generous thing to do, to tell them that, but you are not morally obligated to do it. Now, that was sort of interesting, but that's the same kind of issue. Anyway, so the place where it comes in our case is the New Orleans tobacco case, which I discuss in the book, which is sort of a neat case where one person in the industry apparently somehow got advance news of the treaty that had ended the war. He therefore knew that tobacco prices in New Orleans would shoot up once the blockade ended, so he bought lots of tobacco. And the court held, in that case at least, he was not obligated to tell the seller why he was buying it and could therefore make his profits. And it's the argument for, obviously, is that that rule does encourage speculation, which I've just argued does good things. Of course, it will encourage inefficient as well as efficient speculation, since, as I've just shown, speculation doesn't have to be. You could imagine the case where I produce no social benefit, but where there was a large cost to me in getting that advanced information, and then there'd be a net loss. And indeed, somebody was telling me about what may well be a real case of that at the moment, that apparently some speculators on, I think, Chicago Board of Trade or something, do the kind of speculation where 30 seconds matters. They're using computers to do their buys and sells, and he was describing one such, which I think had put in or was putting in a fiber optic cable in order to communicate, I'm not sure whether communicating between maybe two different markets or something, in order that they could get their buy-in, thereby ordered in a few seconds earlier than with the existing. Well, that fiber optic cable doesn't look like it's producing any obvious social benefit, and yet it was profitable for them to do it. That was at least the story he heard, which I thought was interesting. All right. Any questions so far? No. Let me go on now to try to discuss these same questions by imagining you're actually designing a contract. And this is partly coming out of the book for my other course, which has a chapter on contract, which was written much more from the what a practical lawyer can learn from the economics relevant to what he does, whereas mine is written more from the standpoint of what an academic economist can say about contracts. So we imagine that you're hiring somebody to build you a house, and then the question is, what are sensible contractual terms? And put aside for a moment the question of enforcing it, suppose we can't enforce the contract, and you can then think of two prototypical contractual arrangements, one of which we call cost plus and one of which we call flat fee. So the flat fee one, I say, look, I will pay you $80,000 to build that house. The cost plus one, we say, you will show me all of your bills, and I will agree to pay you the amount of all of your bills for expenses building my house, plus an extra $10,000 because your bill is not showing your own time and expertise and so forth. All right? And there's really a third variant, which is cost plus 10%. That is one where the plus is a percentage of the total expenses, which we will be mentioning later, but we can forget for the moment. I think it makes sense. Sort of the first question on cost plus to an economist is, why is there any plus at all? If my cost plus is cost plus 10,000, why isn't there someone who'll do it for cost plus 9,000? And I think the plausible answer is that not all costs are easily measurable or show up on paper, and that the fact that you may have to decline some other house that would have made you money while I'm doing it is itself a cost. So then the question is, what are the advantages and disadvantages of those? And suppose we have a flat fee contract, what is the incentive to the builder to save costs? One of the considerations we would like to have is that he not buy windows for $100 each when if he looked around a little longer he could buy them for $60 each, and that he not use beautiful black walnut for paneling that's going to have wallpaper over it, and so forth and so on. So the question is, if it's a flat fee contract, what is his incentive with regard to costs?
Save as much as possible.
Every dollar he saves goes into his pocket, right? What about if it's a cost plus contract? What? Cost plus 10%, he wants to spend as much as possible. Cost plus, he doesn't care.
Right.
And there may be other, there are really reputational and other things that are coming in, but we just take just for the contract terms. Cost plus, he doesn't care. Is either of those optimal for you? Let's start with the flat fee. What's the problem with the flat fee contract?
You can spend more than...
Flat fee? What flat fee is one you agree on when you're in pain.
Right. So you might spend more than you would otherwise make a cost plus.
From the standpoint of the two of you together, as it were, that is, whether the flat fee is better or not than the cost plus... For you, obviously, it depends on what the fee is and what the plus is. But if you think about from sort of economic efficiency standpoint, if you ask why might one be better or worse than the other, so what incentives would you like him to have with regard to saving cost? If you could.
I guess time, because he spends too much time trying to find the cheapest goods, and then slow down the end result.
Might slow it down, but it also hurts you in a more indirect fashion. Remember that whatever, at least from the economist standpoint, we believe everybody's rational, whatever terms you agree to, any inefficiency which results in a cost to him, you're going to pay for because it's going to go into what that flat fee is, right? He's going to go into it setting a flat fee at which he can cover his costs. So if the result of the flat fee contract is that any dollar he saves, he makes. He is then going to be willing to spend effort on saving dollars, up to a dollar per dollar. Well, if he anticipates the incentive to make him spend 70 cents on finding a cheaper product, that's going to be 70 cents more he's going to be charging initially with a flat fee. That's all right if you're saving a dollar from your standpoint. Saving a dollar costs 70 cents. That's the right answer. But that cost is, it's worth seeing that non-monetary cost to him, you're really paying it. It's just that you're paying it in advance rather than paying it in its depending whether he does it or not. All right? Hope that's clear. It's a little confusing what you're putting in. What's the downside of giving him an incentive to save money? In particular, that... Can you just reword that?
They'll build crappy walls. I don't know.
He has an incentive to have the lower quality.
Right, yeah.
All right. So that if he can reduce cost at a cost in quality, it's in his interest to do so. All right. So therefore, simple way of putting it is that the problem with a fixed price contract, the virtue is that it gives an incentive to save cost. The vice is that it gives him an incentive to do so even at the result of producing a lower quality product for you. All right, so far? So suppose for some reason you had decided on a fixed price contract. How might you try to protect yourself?
Quality standards.
You might specify that, depending on what you're doing, in particular imagining a house, but you might say, here are the recommendations of some official body or other or some professional association about what kind of plumbing you ought to use for houses like this and what grade of windows and so forth. Your contractual agreement includes an agreement to do those things. And you might have a problem if you're not expert enough. You might want to hire somebody else. You might want to have an architect, or you have to have anyway and say to the architect, how about giving him a specific list of characteristics of inputs and saying he can vary that only with my permission. So if he comes to me and says, look, I know it specifies that the piping, the plastic piping for the plumbing has got to have, should have 10-inch thick walls, but I found somebody who's got even better plumbing with, 0.12-inch thick walls, who happens to be selling it at a great discount because they were supplying you mine and vice versa for that, because they sure assume you believe you can check with your architect to make sure he's telling the truth. But so one possibility is that you would try to specify quality characteristics to be vary only with your permission. Let's take it one step further. In deciding between a flat fee contract and alternative, one question is how well you can control the problem with a flat fee contract. So if you're imagining different possible contracts, what are the ones for which you might reasonably say flat fee is a real problem, and what ones you say flat fee is ideal to keep our costs down? What matters? Let me take the case which we will be getting into next week of what I think I described earlier as the most important long-term contract you will ever sign, namely marriage. Clearly, we can solve all the problems of marriage by saying that part of the marriage contract is that she agrees to be a good wife and you agree to be a good husband. Is that going to solve the quality problem? Why is it not going to solve the quality problem?
Because it can't really be monitored.
Because it can't be enforced, it can't be monitored. So that means that one of the important considerations in deciding on whether a flat fee contract makes sense is how easy it is to monitor quality. If you imagine, for example, that the real quality problem is how skilled his workers are. Well, it's going to be very hard for you to say those bricks are laid a little less precisely than they should have been because you've got a half-trained bricklayer instead of a skilled bricklayer. You can think of a lot of other things of that sort where you can easily enough imagine. On the other hand, if the only relevant question is, does he use hardwood or softwood or plywood or, which brand of paint he uses, then it's more plausible that you could write out the set of specifications. So you want to think in general, in everything in contracts, everything in enforceable contracts at least, that one of the questions always is what you can monitor, what you can observe, what you can or can't know. And ideally what you can or can't prove to a court, which is what somebody else can observe, what an external party can observe. So suppose for a moment, to go back to the point about his time and trouble, suppose you said, what I'm going to do, instead of using a flat fee contract to make him save money, I'm going to use a cost-plus contract where the contract will say that he must buy everything at the lowest possible price and will suffer serious penalties if he doesn't. You see any? Suppose you could monitor that. Do you see any problems with that?
Is it ambiguous? How much time are you supposed to spend?
That's the problem, but I wouldn't call it ambiguous. The problem is, suppose he can save $1 on costs with $2 on searching. All right. Suppose that he spends enough of his time and effort searching, he can get a somewhat lower price. And if you can show he didn't get the lowest price, he'll owe you a bunch of money for penalty. So therefore, he has an incentive to spend $2 searching for a $1 saving. He'll know that going in, so he'll charge you a high flat fee to compensate for that. Let me give you a different version of the same issue. And that is that when people are talking about problems with taxation, a standard argument is that income tax reduces the incentive to work, right? Because some of the money you're worrying goes to the government. And suppose something, that's absolutely right. And it just so happens that we're in Alaska, and Alaska's got a big revenue from natural resources. So after we cut our income tax to zero, we're going to take another step. We're going to cut it to minus 20%. So every time you earn $1, the state of Alaska will give you 20 cents. And he said, look, do people say incentives are good? That's going to increase your incentive to work. Is that a good or a bad arrangement?
And the state of Alaska is paying out of revenue that doesn't come from
people? Yeah, right. Okay. They do. That is, they don't do it in that form. Revenue, they do pay a lump sum per citizen. They may have taxes as well for all I know. Alaska, the state owns a bunch of natural resources. They get sizable income from that, and they, in the past, I think still, you get $500 a year or something for living in Alaska, make up for the hardships.
What would be wrong? Thinking it was them with economic efficiency, maximizing the size of the pie. Why wouldn't the fact that you would then work harder because you're getting an extra 20 cents on the dollar be a good thing?
Sounds great.
Well, let's go further. We don't even have to limit that. Well, how about we do it this way? We don't have natural resources, so what we're going to do is say everybody pays a $20,000 a year tax, a flat sum tax, and we'll give it back to you at a dollar per dollar for every dollar you earn. So now everybody is working, you know, 60-hour weeks to make back the money. They're ending up with the same amount as they had, neither tax nor subsidy. Are they better or worse off?
Aren't they the same, but then there's just the cost of administering? If you're giving them a dollar for a dollar.
They're the same in dollars. Are they doing the same thing? Do they have the same, they have a higher income, they have more money because they're working that 60 hours. So in addition to the money you give them back, they've got their ordinary wage for the extra 20 hours. Are they better off or worse off?
The money comes from them.
You're an individual worker. Here's the deal. Beginning of the year, we send you a bill for $20,000, which you somehow pay. Your savings or something. During the year, you get a dollar for a dollar. You would have worked a 40-hour week and made $10,000. My number's low just because my year is easy. Instead, you're going to work an 80-hour week and make $20,000. Government now, having taken $20,000 from you, is giving you back $20,000. Dollar for a dollar. Are you better or worse off? Government is a wash. The government is taking $20,000 and giving you $20,000. Are you better or worse off?
Worse because you're working more.
And you're also making more money.
I guess if you wanted to make more money, you want to work more.
That's right. The answer is we already know that those 740 hours a week were a larger cost to you than the money was worth. That's why you didn't work them before. So what we're doing is giving you an incentive to work. That the problem with the income tax is you don't have an incentive to earn that last dollar that cost you 90 cents of effort because you're only getting 80 cents of the dollar. The problem with this one is you have an incentive to earn one more dollar, which costs you a dollar and 10 cents in effort. Both of those make you worse off, either direction. That's this very common mistake in rhetoric of people talking that incentive was good. The right incentive is good. Too much incentive or too little incentive is bad. Well, go back to our contract. In the deal where he gets heavily penalized for not using the cheap, the least expensive good, he has too much incentive to save you money. Saving money is good, but it's only good by a certain amount. It's only good for a dollar per dollar, and therefore you don't want people to make $2 per dollar by saving money, because then they'll try too hard, as it were. All right? Make sense? All right, so that's the flat fee contract. Now let's go to the cost plus contract. Let's take a cost plus a fixed amount for a moment. Now, you have no incentive to keep costs down. That's clearly a problem, so maybe we'll have to have some contractual agreement on, this time not on quality, but on cost. How about quality? Do you have the right incentive?
Quality seems like it would be governed by another term. If there's a warranty in the contract, might be. Quality might just be inherent in the amount of money that you're spending on the product, but quality wouldn't be determined so much.
In this particular agreement, it looks as though you don't care what quality you do. You can buy really high quality stuff and charge me for it, or you can buy low quality stuff and charge me for it. So we don't have to worry that you'll use the cheaper, that you'll use low quality stuff to make money. We might have to worry that you use high quality stuff because you'll be able to say to people, look at this beautiful house I built. Or you might not. But something other than just the terms of the contract is going to determine the quality that you use. You can imagine a case where you say, well, in doubt, use the highest quality because then he won't complain. And then you would get probably too high a quality, higher quality than the buyer wanted to pay for.
Yep. Wouldn't speed be efficiently higher? Speed at which you finish the house? Because you would just invest more money. If you're going to get reimbursed for whatever you use, you're just going to invest more money.
I see. You're going to want to minimize your time. Yeah. What you're really saying, that's right. And in fact, the same thing I mean, it's really, in a sense, the same as the problem you were just saying, that you wouldn't have an incentive to save money by getting the cheapest version of a given quality, because it would take your time and effort to find the best price, and you're getting no reward for it. And similarly, you're right that I have an incentive to spend money on things that will result in my spending less of my time doing this, which could happen in a variety of different ways. One of them would be a higher rank would work overtime, because that way it takes fewer of my days to do.
Are we assuming that the contract or whatever, his time is part of the cost, or does he?
I am assuming that the plus in the cost plus is intended to compensate him for what you expect his time to be. You could certainly imagine a version where he logs his own time, but that's going to be a little hard to.
Yeah, it seems like he would have the incentive then to, even if he has the high quality goods, to then maybe spend as much little time as possible putting it together.
And he might have a time incentive to hire people whose wages will go onto your bill to do things he could otherwise do more cheaply himself. That would be, in a sense, the same kind of problem. So all of that is suggesting that in a sense, what you want to do is to, in your imagination, draw up a contract and then say, what will go wrong? And then say, all right, what will go wrong with this contract is that he'll use low-quality goods, so therefore it makes sense only if we can specify quality well enough. What will go wrong with this contract is that he won't shop for good prices. Whether that's a problem, well, if the inputs are all things where the price is always very well known, then we don't have to worry about that. If the inputs are the sort of thing where looking a little harder might get you a much better deal, then that's important and we have to worry about it. So that's the sort of issues you might want to find about.
Was there any difference? Are you
going to
get to cost plus 10%?
10%, yes. Cost plus 10%, I think the problem with cost plus 10% is pretty obvious, that it by itself actually gives an incentive to gold plate the project, to make things more expensive, either by using higher quality goods or in other ways.
I was just going to ask you, when would that be advantageous for both parties?
I don't know why. I mean, I guess the real answer probably is that the reason for cost plus 10% is that you don't really know how much of this time and effort it's going to take, and you think that the cost is going to be a proxy for that. You say, look, imagine you are drilling a well, and sometimes, a day and a half, there comes the water, and sometimes, oops, sorry, we didn't hit it, let's move over here, try again, go deeper. So that takes him a week instead of a day, and the fact that he had to rent the drilling stuff for seven times as long. So that might be the reason, but I don't really know. That's sort of a guess. With regard to cost plus 10%, let me give you some really useful bit of economics, which is Friedman's rule for finding the men's room. And Friedman's rule for finding the men's room is that it's adjacent in one of the three dimensions to the women's room. And therefore, you happen to have noticed the women's room, you know about where the men's room is. The reason for this is economies of scale in plumbing stacks. The plumbing stack is the bunch of pipes that you need for a washroom or a kitchen or something. And it is cheaper to have one somewhat larger one supporting two restrooms than to have two separate ones supporting separate restrooms.
So there's multiple floors and also be above each other.
Above each other or next to each other, say one of the three dimensions. And it doesn't always apply in the basement because there the stack is running horizontally. And getting back to our subject, it does not apply to governments built to buildings built on government contracts that cost plus 10%.
So one other problem you ought to worry about in the cost plus contract, even the regular cost, not cost plus 10%, is making sure that you can really monitor cost. Because you can easily enough imagine the case where he's got a supplier and he agrees, and the supplier normally discounts to builders 10%. But he says, look, I'll pay you the full price. And you think you give me a really good deal on my house, which I'm also building? So you'd have to worry about the degree to which the paperwork really represents the costs given that deal. And you have to worry about that with a fixed price contract. So there are problems in each case, and you're really looking at where are the problems, and therefore you have to worry about. Another problem that's going to arise in these contracts is the problem due to uncertainty, namely what happens if there is some change in conditions and you have to renegotiate. So maybe your client imagine you're the lawyer for a moment rather than the person, forgot an important feature, has to renegotiate it. Well, one answer is when you're drawing up the contract, are you really sure there's nothing you've left out? Because if there is, it's going to be hard, or something could have changed. And in both of those cases, and this again is going to get us back to our subject of next week, the problem is that going into the contract, you have a competitive market here. You can take bids from multiple builders, but once the house is half built, you've got a bilateral monopoly. And bilateral monopolies, as we've discussed, tend to lead to bargaining costs because of the danger of each person trying to shove the agreement to his end of the bargaining range. So that's a potential problem that you'd have to worry with. And so that could be expensive. And as I was mentioning before, a very important case of this situation is marriage, that we would all like to convince ourselves after we're married that she was the only possible woman in the world for us, but a little bit of a mathematical calculation will suggest that if that were really the typical case, there would be very few marriages. I actually did do some estimates after I found my present wife, and very rough estimate, and I calculated she was about a 1 in 100,000 catch. And, what? 200,000? All right, sorry. I'm going by memory. Right. But even then, if I kept searching, you know, I would say, and you know, I've met a few other, not very many other women, but a few other women who might have been as well suited in my life. However, even if ex ante, some other alternative might be as good or better, once you're committed, we have two children together, we've lived a long life together, we have a house together and three cats, and she's learned how to put up with me, which is a fairly rare skill, and so forth and so on. Therefore, the costs of switching at this point would be much, much higher than they would have been before.
Y'all? I just wonder if she pressed you at all for how you got that.
I do not remember whether, and I doubt I could reproduce the calculations anymore. I think, you know, I probably was including just sort of age, was including IQ, which would probably be the big, that would probably take out about 99% of potential ones, and then sort of personality kinds of things. And it was all sort of very rough guesses, but numbers get up pretty high if you think of a whole bunch of things, all of which you want. Right, you know, if you say, well, you know, 1 in 100 intelligence, you want somebody. I mean, one of the reasons I think our marriage works is that I like being center stage and she likes not being center stage. So from her standpoint, having me present in some, you know, say a science fiction convention means that she can hide behind me and still have good conversations because I start the conversations. And that kind of personality is, I don't know, 1 in 4, 1 in 5, 1 in 10, who knows, but that kind of numbers. And there are a bunch of variables of that sort that I required not only somebody who was very smart, but somebody whom ideas were real. I mean, that was one of... I will tell you my story about this. After my first marriage broke up, I was at the Virginia Polytechnic Institute, and I was sitting in the kitchen of the house that was the Public Choice Center at VPI. It had originally been a house. Reading a newspaper article about a Persian miniature from the Houghton Shahnameh, I think, which is a collection of a book of Persian miniatures that had sold for some fabulous price. And one of my colleagues, Nick Titteman, came in. And I mentioned this to him and mentioned that I had a replica edition of the Houghton Shahnameh. And I thought it was interesting that you could have a good replica of the whole book for whatever, $100 or $50, and here one miniature by itself was selling for $50,000 or something like this, and discussing sort of interest to economists why things are the value they are to people. And I was arguing that for many people, including me, the history of an object as well as its physical characteristics matter. The fact that this chair belonged to Napoleon really makes it more valuable. And I ran through some other examples of that sort. And Nick said he didn't see that at all. And I said, well, look, the wedding ring you're wearing, surely the fact that that was the ring with which you married Estelle gives it a value that another otherwise identical ring would have. Well, this isn't the ring with which I married Estelle. Every once in a while I see another one I like better and I switch rings. And I finally got Nick to concede that he wasn't willing to trade wives on the same terms. Not with me, I didn't have a wife at that point to trade, but that if he found another wife, another woman who was just as well qualified, the fact that he lived X years with this one would make a difference. And he went out, and I was feeling really good. And I said, why am I feeling really good? Because I've had a conversation with ideas where I didn't feel as though I needed a translator. that Nick is the kind of person to whom ideas are also real, and therefore you don't have to go into all the details. We can both see why these are interesting questions. If I ever marry again, I need somebody who has that character. And I found someone, fortunately. Anyway, but that's all a digression. So, where was I? Here we are. Anyway, what about including in your contract terms for changing? Is that going to be easier with flat fee or with cost plus? Sure, because cost plus, the other guy doesn't really object when you change. You know, you decided you need to put in an extra bathroom. All right, we'll cost you. Whereas flat fee, we'd have to negotiate if we're going to keep it flat fee. Now, you could do both. You could say, well, it's flat fee as specified in the contract, and then it'll be cost plus if I decide to make any additional changes. That would be one way you might think about doing it. What about risk bearing? If something changes, it increases the cost under flat fee. In effect, the builder has insured you. He's the one who swallows the cost. Under cost plus, you're the one who swallows the cost, so that's going to matter. And for reasons we've discussed before, how you allocate risk changes the size of the pie for three different reasons. One of them is risk aversion, that one of you may be more easily able to bear the risk. Perhaps I'm a wealthy person, and this is actually going to my third house for when the weather's too bad at the other two. So if the price goes up, I don't care very much. Or perhaps he's not really a builder, but a building firm building 50 houses. So if one of them goes up, it's just sort of averages in, as it were. But also because of the arguments we discussed before about adverse selection and moral hazard. That if it's a certain one way of putting it is that the problem with cost plus of his using more expensive goods is a moral hazard problem, and the problem with fixed price of his lowing quality is a moral hazard problem. Right? That's really the logic of that is the same that we've been through before. All right, I think that covers the stuff I wanted to say about those things. So now before I start talking about the China to Cyberspace article, which I thought was sort of a fun article, why don't you tell me if you had questions about that article that you'd like to discuss? Yes?
I just had a small clarification for one thing in it. There's one point where you write, there's two sentences. Nonetheless, we observe the use of hostages in contexts where a deposit would be of little use.
Yes.
One explanation is that parties who wish to give hostages are able to commit themselves not to accept such offers. Does that mean, like, willing to sacrifice the hostages?
Yes,
or
right.
Or retaliate or something?
Well, willing to refuse to buy the hostage back.
Okay, that's all. Yes. That's it.
Yes, right. I should say, I believe that's the point where I've got a footnote to my daughter. That is where she was the one who made the Coastian point about why hostages might not work because, right? And it's an important point to think about in lots of contexts. The context where I've thought about it before is I've got an article on the virtues of inefficient punishment where the question is, why don't we try to set up a punishment system where all punishments are as efficient as possible? It would be collect fines whenever you can, which would include saying your punishment is a year in jail, but for every $1,000 you can pay us as a fine, we'll take a week off of it. That would be a very sensible arrangement if you're just trying to minimize the cost of punishment. Or we're going to execute people, while we execute them, disassemble them and have their organs available for transplant. As you may have heard, there was just a news story recently about the fact that Pakistan, under Islamic law, one possible outcome if you're killing somebody is you pay blood money who was killed. And apparently they suggested the CIA has done this in order to get one of their people out who had killed two people. He claimed self-defense, but other people thought not. So you can think of lots of ways you could try. For that matter, if you're going to lock people up, make the prison as unpleasant as possible. And that way, a year in hell is going to be the same deterrent effect as 3 years in an ordinary prison or 5 years in a country club prison. And it'll cost us much less to maintain hell for a year than to maintain that in 3 or 5. So you think of lots of ways in which you could modify your punishment, we'll get to this later, to make it more efficient. And the question is, why don't you do all of those things? And the argument I offer is basically if you want to worry about the punishment being too efficient, because then people have an incentive to punish you whether or not you're guilty. That's the people worry about court problems and class actions and punitive damages at present. And
that if all I can do when I punish you is to lock you up, and that costs me money too, I'm going to be much less eager to do it unless I have strong reasons such as that we need to lock you up because you're killing people. And the problem is that if we have an inefficient punishment and we have out-of-court settlements, you can convert an inefficient punishment to an efficient punishment by saying, well, look, the punishment is that you're going to be locked up for 3 years, but you can do a plea bargain in which you agree to pay us a fine of $80,000, Mr. Milliken, in exchange for our not locking you up. All right, that in some circumstances is possible. Where that isn't possible in lots of criminal cases, we can do a different kind of plea bargain, which is we'll let you off with a tap on the wrist just as long as you will testify that by a very lucky coincidence, the cellmate you put you with last night, who was up for a really important crime, happened to confess that crime to you last night. He was having a hard time getting to sleep. And so that's, again, a Coasean bargain. We're trading perjured testimony that you provide for the So that's a way in which it's harder, as it were, to keep a system of punishments inefficient, which is the same real issue here. All right, so let's go through the China stuff. And what we really have are two legal systems, one historical and one coming into existence, and the historical one is Imperial China, which ended about the end of the 19th century, just after that, I think. And on the evidence, at least the Taiwanese evidence that I cite there, it looks as though there's essentially no contract law, and in fact nothing we would really think of as enforcement of civil law at all. And that may be an oversimplification, but at least that's the impression I get from the account of that system. And yet, there was elaborate contractual practice up to modern standards, essentially. And then I argue there, and I've been arguing for a long time, that in dealing with people online, you have a technology which makes it possible to combine anonymity and authentication. And if you have a world where people are routinely dealing with other people and don't know what content those other people are on or what their real name is, that makes it hard to use a legal system to enforce contract. You know, forced into a contract. How many of you are familiar with public key encryption? One person. All right. I want to send a message that to you that if he intercepts, he can't read it. And the standard old-fashioned method is I have some formula for scrambling and unscrambling the message. The description of the formula is called the key. It says, how do you scramble and unscramble it? I make sure you've got a copy of the key. I've got a copy of the key. I scramble the message. I send the message to you. You unscramble. And the weakness of that, especially if you're imagining not sort of highly secret organizations, but ordinary people dealing with each other all the time, is how do I get the key? Because if I don't have a safe way of getting messages to you, I probably don't have a safe way of getting keys to you, and if he's intercepted the key and taken a copy, now he can read our messages when we think he can. Public key encryption was a mathematical breakthrough, I suppose, by now 30 years ago or 40 years ago, which demonstrated a way in which you can generate a pair of keys which function as inverses, in the sense that you generate them together by a mathematical process. They're both numbers. And if I use A to scramble the message, somebody who only has A can't unscramble. It takes B to unscramble it. If I use B to scramble it, it takes A to unscramble it. All right? So now what do? I declare key A is my private key, and no one else is ever going to see it. Right? That's the only real secrets are one known to only one person. B is my public key, and everybody in the world has it. I publish it, I put it up on signboards. I distribute it any way I can. Now, if I want to send you a message, if you want to send me a message, you encrypt the message with my public key. You send it to me, and I decrypt it with my private key. If he has a copy of your public key, he can send me secret messages too. But he can't read your message, because that requires the private key. Not only does this mean, imagine a world where everybody has such a pair of keys, and where everybody has somehow managed to make a public key public. Discuss the problems and how you make public keys public and make sure someone doesn't pretend that his public key is your public key so he can read the messages. Assuming we've got a way, it's not that hard, I think, to make public keys public. Now, in that world, everybody can send messages to everybody else, which nobody, including the FBI, can read. All right? Makes sense. So that's potentially a very private world. Now, we still have a problem in that world, which is, how do you prove that you're you? Because if I'm going to engage in business relations with you or hire you as a consultant, it matters that not what you look like, not how old you are, but you're the same guy who the last 10 times gave me good advice. And the answer is the same technology does that. Because to prove that you're you, you encrypt a message with your private key, send it to me along with an unencrypted note saying who it's from. I decrypt it with your public key. Remember, each one is the interactive, reverses the other. So that the fact that the message is not gibberish when I decrypt it tells me it was encrypted with your private key. You're the only person in the world who has that private key, so you've just proved that you're you. That could either be used to prove your real space identity, if what I know is this is the public key of John Q. Smith who lives in Topeka, or your cyberspace identity, if you had established a reputation online. In establishing that reputation, you published your public key for that reputation, who it really is, and now you can prove that you're the person behind that identity, as it were. So it gives you a digital signature. This is not a digital signature's work, although it's a more elaborate procedure, it's a practical matter. A procedure by which you can simultaneously have anonymity and reputation. You're anonymous in that no one has to know your real space identity, but you have a reputation, and then you can prove you're the same cyberspace person over and over again. And that has a lot of... It's a very powerful technology. I got into a good deal of this stuff due to, in particular, somebody called Tim May, who I knew, who was part of a group called Cypherpunks, who were an email list that I suppose pretty much went out of business maybe 10 years ago. For some years, they were people who were discussing sort of social and other implications of this set of technologies. It turns out that one of them was Julian Assange, the guy behind WikiLeaks. And in fact, that there was a very one of my blog posts has a link to a very interesting article on Assange, and which I came across to that reference to me because I'm corresponding in this thing, although I was really sort of a tangential part of this set of people. And variously, people were arguing this technology had enormous potential within us. And there's a quote from Assange that I'm going to use on my webpage when I get around to it, with regard to WikiLeaks, that the homemade nitroglycerin in the old cypherpunk's blast shack finally went off. That's WikiLeaks. That's a case where this set of technology that had all the potential and suddenly exhibited that potential fairly strangely. The same article has at least quotes from Assange, what he thought he was doing with WikiLeaks, which I thought was actually quite interesting, which was that the real purpose is not to publicize bad things done by people. The real purpose is to make it more expensive to be an organization that has to have secrets. His real argument was, if there's an easy way in which leaks that will hurt you could get publicized, then an organization which is doing stuff that it can't afford to have known has to take a lot of precautions, has to be internally paranoid, as it were. That makes it harder for such organizations to fund. He described it as a privacy tax. No, a secrecy tax. I'm not sure he's right, but it's sort of a neat and subtle kind of idea of how you change the world by introducing something new to it. Anyway, I only realized very recently that Assange used that. All this attention is really part of the same world I'm writing about, but he's using it in a slightly different way. So what are the consequences? One consequence is that you can imagine somebody who is doing things very unpopular with some person or government, a public figure, as it were, public intellectual, only nobody knows who he is, and he doesn't have to worry about being assassinated or arrested. And that, in a sense, is in the WikiLeaks case, Assange, you know who he is, but presumably many of the other people involved in this, you don't. There's no way of finding out. It also has the undesirable consequence of making possible criminal firms with brand name reputation. So that I have, I don't think it's in this article, but elsewhere, I've got my business plan for Murder Incorporated, in which you basically, first you publicize your public key, then you put a message, an encrypted message in some place like the New York Times classified ads, then you murder a bunch of people in a very public way. I was thinking a bomb at the Academy Awards might do the job. Then you announce that if you use this publicized public key to decrypt that message, you will find the description of the assassination published the day before it happened. Now everybody in the world knows your public key and knows you're going to kill people. And so now they can hire you to kill people, knowing that the messages of intercepted can't be decrypted. technologies can also be used to produce anonymous digital cash. Not something that's happened yet, but we know how to do it, which is a way in which I can make payments to you without either of us knowing who the other person is, just how to get messages back and forth, and without the bank that's really holding the money ever having known who either of us is. And that's, again, a solved problem mathematically, although as a social institution, it requires a bank willing to cooperate someplace where it won't get shut down by local authorities. So that means you could have a world, what I call a world of strong privacy, in which people are routinely dealing with each other in information transactions. Physical transactions, you can trace them. Information transactions, you sometimes can't, without any external authority having control over them. And that then raises the same kind of issues as the China case. How do you manage contracts when nobody can ever sue anybody for breach of contracts? And that's why it struck me that these two cases I looked at were actually very different. Why do you want to be anonymous, by the way, is an interesting question. And one reason is you don't want to pay income tax on your income. Another reason is that you're living in some third world country where being known to have lots of money is very dangerous because you or your kids might get kidnapped or the government might decide on a special tax on you or whatever. You can think of a variety of reasons of that sort, as well as reasons such as that you're selling murder as a profession. So, like many changes you can imagine, this one would have both upside and downside effects. It would make it harder for governments to enforce laws. That's good when they're enforcing laws that shouldn't be enforced, and bad when they're enforcing laws that should be enforced. Fairly obvious. But it does give you, as I like to say, freedom of speech that does not depend on the opinions of the Supreme Court. So then in the cyberspace version, how do we do contract? And this gets back to the point which I think I made before, that in order for reputational enforcement to work, you have to be able to make it inexpensive for interested third parties to know who cheated. And the same technology I'm describing gives you a very elegant way of doing that. It goes as follows. You and I draw up a contract, and we digitally sign the contract, both of us, so that the contract has a copy that I have encrypted with my private key and given to you, a copy you have encrypted with your private key and given to me, and that means that that either of us can show our copy to him, and he knows the other person agreed to it, because it couldn't have been encrypted with my private key without my consent. All right? So one of the things in the contract is he is the arbitrator and it gives his public key. So now we have a dispute. And I go to him to arbitrate the dispute. And he talks to both of us, communicates with both of us, and concludes that indeed you're in the wrong and that you owe me $20,000. And you either do or don't pay me $20,000. If you don't pay me $20,000, he then writes up a statement of the case, in particular that we agreed to his arbitration, that his arbitration found you to be at fault with a $20,000 debt, and that you failed to pay that, and he digitally signs it with his private key. He sends that to me. I then have a package. Our contract that you signed, specifying him as arbitrator, his result that he signed, saying you're the bad guy. I put that package up on the web with your name all over it. Anybody who does a Google search for you, your online name, I don't know who you are in the real world, but your online identity, which is the reputation I'm trying to tarnish. All right? Anybody who wants to check your reputation finds that, and in 0.3 seconds, his computer can determine you're the bad guy. Because all it has to know is you agreed to his arbitration, and he then said that you were at fault. And those are both verified by your digital signature and his digital signature. So it's potentially a very powerful technology for reputational enforcement via arbitration. So much on cyberspace. Let's now go back to both of the cases. That is not the specific case of cyberspace, but to the general issue of contracting when you don't have court enforcement. And in a world of certainty, you ought to be able to eliminate all opportunistic breach just by how you time payment and performance. That is, in a world of certainty, you agree, you're building the house, and I pay you as you're building the house an amount such that it never pays you to walk away with what you've now been paying and stop working, and such that it never pays me to stop paying you and take what you've done so far. So that's just a matter of structuring the rate at which I pay versus the cost of building the house.
In an uncertain world, there's no guarantee we can do that, because after we've agreed in advance on that, your costs might go up or down, the value of the house to me might go up or down. And the problem, which I discussed, which is what ends up with hostages, is that we can shift our incentives. If I give you a deposit initially, which you're going to be able to hold if I breach, that pushes down my incentive to breach, and we can push it down so that at no point during the process do I profit by breaching. But you can now breach and walk away with the contract. This is a world without courts. All right. So that means that using the deposit shifts who has an incentive to breach, but it doesn't eliminate it. And that's then when I discussed the idea of hostages, which struck me as an interesting and powerful idea, which is that I can give you a deposit which turns into ashes when you confiscate it. That's a way of thinking about sort of, I don't know how many of you read fantasy or fairy stories, but, you know, fairy gold turns into ashes or something rather when it touches iron or something like that. So I give you a deposit such that it'll cost me if you confiscate it, but won't help you. And there, the classic example is a literal hostage. This is where I usually tell the story of William Marshall. I told you the story. Anybody know who William Marshall was? And none of you are really into English medieval history, in which he was a very famous man. William Marshall was born the fourth son of a minor noble in England, and before he died, he was regent of England, ruling England for John's son after John's death. In between, he was the top tournament in Western Europe. He was a man who I like to imagine thinking of Richard the Lionhearted as a talented amateur. He's an interesting character. He sort of is giving you a picture of medieval Europe, but the relevant bit, yeah.
I'm sorry, what century was he?
Contemporary Richard the Lionhearted. He worked for Henry II.
Okay.
Just survived John's 12th, I guess it was 12th, I think it would be.
Yeah.
12th, maybe, beginning of 13th, yeah. Somewhere around there. As you may or may not know, there is a rather unpleasant English Civil War, which is, I think, the beginning of the 1100s between Stephen and Matilda, that when, I think it's William II, no, I guess it's Henry I, I think, dies, and his daughter is the Empress Matilda, Empress because she had been married to the Holy Roman Emperor. And it is clear that she can't be the sovereign, as law stands at the time, because she's a woman. The question is, I think, whether her son, who at this point is, I think, an infant, can inherit with somebody holding for it. And the King Henry is in favor of that. So Henry essentially makes everybody in sight swear to support his daughter for the succession via mention from her son. I think that's right. And unfortunately, from that standpoint, however, when he dies, she is not on the scene, and his nephew, I think, Stephen, is. And furthermore, Stephen's brother is Archbishop of Canterbury and promptly crowns Stephen King. And there is then, about a 12-year civil war between the partisans and the two sides. And William Marshall's father, Gilbert Marshall, was, by the standards of that civil war, an honest man because he only changed sides once. He starts out fighting for Stephen and then fairly early goes over to Matilda's side. And at one point during the civil war, Gilbert is holding a castle for Matilda, and Stephen shows up in front of him with an army and says, "Surrender." And Gilbert says, "I got a deal for you. You could, of course, take the castle, but it would take you time and money and people killed and so forth. What I'll offer instead, give me 3 days. I'm going to send a message to Matilda asking her to relieve the siege, to bring an army to free me. If in 3 days she doesn't come, I'll surrender." Stephen was confident Matilda had no army within 3 days, free to come lift the siege. Said, "Sounds like a good deal, but how do I know you'll keep the deal?" And then Gilbert says, "I'll give you my son William as a hostage." And so he gave William's son 10 or something at this time. And he does. And Stephen takes his army and goes off somewhere to do other things to do with his army. And Gilbert starts hiring mercenaries and buying supplies and getting ready for a siege. And Stephen comes back in 3 days and says, and Gilbert also knows that Matilda has no army available to relieve him. And so Stephen comes back in 3 days and says, "Time, give me the castle." And Gilbert says, "Ha, fooled you." And Stephen says, "I'll kill the kid." And Gilbert says, "Have I not 3 more sons? And yet the hammer and the anvil with which to forge more?" And Stephen
who seems to have been a little bit soft-hearted for the job of fighting the Civil War in England at the beginning of the 12th century, makes various gestures towards killing William, but never actually does. And if he had, presumably the gesture would have been quite different. We don't know exactly how, given all the things. And I suppose 60 years later, roughly, John dies. William, at that point, is a very powerful baron due to having married very well, and had a lot of reputation, as in lots of ways. And John, who has not gotten along very well with William throughout his life, when dying, he asks the people around him to ask William to take over his regent. I should say that when John dies, there is a French army in London commanded by the heir to the throne of France, the Dauphin. This is something that the English don't emphasize. They're supposed to invade France, not the other way around, but this was a result of the baronial war between John and his own barons. Within 6 months, the French are back in France, England is at peace, and England's hope dies. So it's an interesting character, but the particular story, though, is sort of my favorite hostage story. You can see how it does or doesn't work, depending on whether you know how valuable the hostage is from the other party and whether you're willing to sacrifice the hostage yourself, as Stephen eventually was not. And you don't know. It could be that Gilbert correctly guessed that Stephen wouldn't kill the kid. We have no way of knowing that. We never will. So that's one solution to the problem of how do you... The ideal contract is one which it never pays anybody to breach. You don't have to go to court. And that's going to be true for you just as it is true for these people. And... So that's one solution, is the hostage. And I suggest in the article that some of the hostages might be things like the threat to report you to the authorities for the crime of cheating, even though I can't sue you for money, I can make things unpleasant for you by reporting you to the authorities. That's, in a sense, a hostage. So is publicizing your breach of contract a hostage, because that'll hurt you in ways that don't benefit me. Another possibility is to say, look, as long as one party has a reputational incentive to keep the contract, that's all we need. Because we've got plenty of ways of giving one party an incentive not to breach, namely by making a deposit. And as long as we aren't scared that that'll make the other party breach, problem is solved. So with one trusted party, you can get a contract with no court enforcement. And I suggest, though I may be wrong, that a lot of the contracts in the real world are of that form. If I think about why, when World of Warcraft has an update and there's this long contract I'm agreeing to terms, and I look through it very quickly and click, yes, I assent to it, why am I not worried that Blizzard will bury in that something that will cost me a fortune? Well, partly I'm not sure that the courts would enforce something that cost me a fortune if it's buried in something, but also partly I know that Blizzard wants to have customers, and they're not going to have customers very long if they have a reputation of cheating them. So in that sense, I suspect a lot of contracts are more one-sided than they would otherwise be because they're one-sided in favor of the party who the other party is willing to trust because he's a repeat player. I suspect that's one of the things going on in the real world. Other ways of not needing courts... one thing is reduce the information cost to third parties so their reputation works better, and part of the way you do that is to have to do your contracts under rules in which cheating is unambiguous, in which it's pretty easy to prove that you never delivered the 3,000 bushels of wheat you said you had sold me. It's much harder to prove, well, they were really of grade C when they were supposed to be of grade B, so you could therefore have contracts which don't specify not easily externally observed characteristics. And another way of dealing with it is to have contracts where as nearly as possible, if you do nothing, you have the right outcome. Therefore, you don't need a court. And caveat emptor is the obvious example of that. If we say, I am not assumed to be warranting my product, so therefore, if you get the product and it breaks, too bad, that's what you bought. That was the term of the deal. Now you don't have to sue me for getting compensation. I have no reason to sue you. So that solves the problem. And if you can think about the general idea of letting costs stay where they fall, that's a rule that doesn't require courts. Related, the idea of combining possession with ownership, of having a system which is not normally the case that I have stuff that belongs to you. Because if I have stuff that belongs to you and it gets damaged, we have a legal controversy over whether I have to compensate you. As we say, look, it belongs to me until I hand it over. It belongs to me. If it gets damaged, that's my problem. Once I've handed it over, you're in control, and therefore if it gets damaged, it's your problem. So there are a bunch of ways along those lines which are ways in which one can
can reduce the need. From my standpoint, the interest in that article was the combined interest of here are two radically different environments that really raise the same set of issues and have some of the same solutions. Because the digital signature in Imperial Chinese law was the chop. It was a physical object. I think they still have them, which was a seal. You stamped it on an ink pad and then stamped it on paper. And presumably with their technology, it was hard enough to make a really accurate copy of my chop that proved I had signed the contract. Right, nowadays, that wouldn't work very well, but I gathered with them, and then it did. And then the third dimension of it, which I don't know if I discuss in the article or not, is the idea that all of this should be interesting, even to lawyers who do have courts that enforce contracts, because using courts is expensive and takes time, and you'd rather try to set up your contracts so you never have to. That was the subject. All right, have a nice weekend.